Today on Straight Talk Africa, a look at the continuing African reaction to the passing of Zimbabwean independence leader, President Robert Gabriel Mugabe, and the significance of the new African president-elect of the United Nations General Assembly. Those discussions are coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. I am Shaka Sali, and today we are taking a look at the legacy of Robert Mugabe, and we examine the importance of having a Nigerian at the helm of the United Nations General Assembly. Hailed as a hero in 1980, former Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe was later seen by some as a tyrant whose policies destroyed the nation that was once one of Africa's most prosperous countries. Mugabe died in Singapore last week at 95. My colleague Paul Ndiho has more on the story.
Robert Gabriel Mugabe was born on February 21, 1924, in what was then a British-ruled southern Rhodesia. He was arguably one of the most highly educated presidents of our time. He went to Catholic schools and 7 university degrees, including 2 law degrees from the University of London's external program, while he was incarcerated. A teacher by profession, Mugabe taught in Zambia and Ghana, where African independence movement leaders influenced him. His political career began in 1960 with the formation of the National Democratic Party. Mugabe was jailed in 1964 for 10 years for fighting against white minority rule. After his release from prison, he went into exile in Mozambique, where he and fellow nationalist Joshua Nkomo joined forces to form the Patriotic Front Golila Alliance to fight the white regime led by Prime Minister Ian Smith. The turning point in the clash came after 3 months of intensive negotiations led to the signing of the Lancaster House Agreement, which oversaw the transition to majority rule. Mugabe became the country's first black prime minister on April 18, 1980. In 1983, Mugabe crushed a rebellion by ex-Zapu guerrillas in Matabeleland. Government forces were accused of killing thousands of civilians. In 1987, he became president with sweeping executive powers after changes to the constitution. In 1990, Robert Mugabe stood unopposed for the newly created post of executive president. In 2000, the controversial government land program was launched to seize farms owned by whites to resettle landless blacks. It's worth noting that the land reform in Zimbabwe officially began in 1980 with the signing of the Lancaster Agreement. In 2001, the United States slaps a financial freeze on Mugabe's government in response to land seizures, triggering a wave of Western sanctions. In 2008, hyperinflation reached an enormous 500 billion percent. The economic impulsion forced millions of people to leave the country, many to neighboring South Africa. Again in 2008, Mugabe loses a presidential vote but wins the runoff after opponent Morgan Tsvangirai withdraws, citing violence against his supporters by security forces and war veterans. A power-sharing agreement is signed. In December 2014, Mugabe appoints Justice Minister Emmerson Mnangagwa as his new vice president. In November 2017, Zimbabwe's Information Minister Simon Kahaya Moyo says Mnangagwa is fired as vice president. Mnangagwa manages to escape over the border into neighboring Mozambique. A couple weeks later, Mugabe is forced to resign on November 21, 2017 as Parliament begins impeachment proceedings. Mugabe finally steps aside after a 37-year reign, sparking celebrations across the country. Robert Mugabe had critics too. Many saw Mugabe as a power-obsessed leader willing to unleash death squads, rig elections, and crush the economy in the relentless pursuit for control. But an apologetic Mugabe portrayed himself as a radical African nationalist competing against racist and imperialist forces in Washington and London. Paul Ndiho, VOA News.
Thanks, Paul, for that report. Joining me here in the studio is Dr. Frank Guni, the ZANU-PF representative for the United States. From Edmonton in Canada, we are joined by Brunette Beatrice Kumalo, a Zimbabwean lecturer and media consultant. And from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare, we have Blessing Zulu, a Voice of America reporter for the Zimbabwe service. Well, Blessing, let me come to you immediately. First of all, good evening, Blessing. How are you?
I'm doing great, Chaka. How is Washington?
Washington is politically and weather-wise very hot. What about Harare?
Harare is fine, of course, with the economic problems. That is what is on most people's minds.
Give us a sense of the mood in the capital, Harare.
You know, with President Robert Mugabe, it's a conflicted legacy, like Paul clearly stated in his video there. People are really conflicted. Some are hailing the late President Robert Mugabe as a hero, but some activists are saying, you know, when it comes to human rights, he was a real monster, and this has forced many Zimbabweans to go into exile.
How was his body received at the Robert Mugabe International Airport in Harare?
Of course, I would put the crowd at around 400, but the government had promised that it was going to provide buses to ferry people to the Robert Gabriel Mugabe International Airport to welcome the former president. But I don't think they did a good job. Most of the people I talked to are people from the capital, Harare, and, neighboring towns like Chitungwiza, and not many people from his traditional rural constituencies were able to come to Harare. So it was a crowd that was rather subdued.
I know that you have interacted with lots of people and talked with other people, probably from Matabeleland, and we're talking about Gukurahundi here. Is there any reaction that is sort of what you would call media unfriendly in as far as the late President Robert Mugabe is concerned?
Of course, many people from Matabeleland that I have talked to are still bitter that former President Mugabe was given several opportunities to apologize for the near genocide or genocide that happened in Matabeleland from 1983 to 1987, where, according to some estimates, more than 20,000 people were killed. He refused to apologize. He only said it was a moment of madness. So, former President Mugabe is hailed as a hero in most African states, but that piece of history in Zimbabwe is something that has tainted his image.
There were some reports, Blessing, that some close or members of the family would have liked to have a private burial rather than a state burial. Have you heard about that?
Yes, I've been working on that story. Actually, I've talked to several family members off and on the record, and what they are saying is that they are not happy with the way he was toppled by President Emmerson Mnangagwa using the military. So they would rather have him interred at his family home in Zwimba, Mashonaland West Province. But yet, some family members are also saying that he is not for the family, but for the nation. Therefore, he must be buried at the National Heroes Acre in Zimbabwe alongside some of his comrades like the late General Solomon Mujuru, Dr. Joshua Nkomo, his vice president, his former vice president, the late Simon Muzenda, Herbert Chitepo, and others. So even today, many people are expecting that President Emmerson Mnangagwa will pronounce the burial place, but he did not say anything about the burial except to say the former president will be buried on Sunday. He urged Zimbabweans to attend in their millions. But where is the burial? Nobody knows.
Do flags remain at half-mast in honor of the late President Gabriel Robert Mugabe?
Indeed, flags are on half-mast, but I've been watching the local ZBC TV. Normally, when a hero dies, you know, the state media is, you know, 24/7 remembering that particular hero. But with Mugabe, things are different, you know, after every 30 or so minutes. But it's not something that you can say Zimbabwe has lost its founding father.
Yes, please. Blessings, are you still there?
Yes, I can hear you.
So what happens tomorrow and the day after before the official burial?
Of course, after his body left the Harare International Airport, he was supposed to lie in state at One Commando Barracks, the army barracks that is near the airport. That is what happens with all heroes. But we understand the family said no, he has to go to his own house, his mansion in Borodale Brook, the so-called Blue Roof. So today his body went to his Borodale residence, and tomorrow his nephew, Leo Mugabe, who also happens to be the spokesperson of the family, says the body will be taken to Rufaro Stadium in Mbare before being flown to his rural home in Zimba. We expect that it will be flown back to Harare, back to Rufaro Stadium again on Friday. And on Saturday, we understand that dignitaries, that includes the diplomats, African presidents and former presidents would be gathered at the national sports stadium to bid the former president farewell. The burial is on Sunday, but we don't know where. National sports national Heroes Acre or his Zimba rural home.
Now, Blessing, when you mentioned President Mugabe's mansion, were you talking about the famously known as Blue Roof?
Indeed, yeah, that is where his body is at the moment.
I see. Well, on that note, thank you very, very, very much for your insight, Blessing.
Thank you, Shaka. The pleasure is mine.
You're most welcome, and of course, take care of yourself downtown Harare.
Thank you so much.
You're most welcome. Let me come to you immediately, Dr. Guni. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Thank you very much.
What is your immediate reaction to the passing away of your former president, Robert Gabriel Mugabe?
I think the immediate reaction is that Zimbabwe has lost a father figure. Zimbabwe has lost its founding father. And Africa has lost an icon, one of the last nationalists who fought for the liberation of not just their own countries, but neighboring countries as well. So it's a deep loss. But on the other hand, Comrade Mugabe, former President Robert Mugabe, lived a full life up to 95 years.
95.
That's a gift of life from God. And we thank God for all those years and the sacrifices he made to help liberate Zimbabwe and leading Zimbabwe to where it is today.
Now, we know that, for example, he was celebrated largely for perhaps having one of the best educational policies in Africa, and in fact, at the time, also some of the best medical care policies in Africa. What about the irony that this is a man who had taken care of people in terms of health, and yet he actually dies in a place called Singapore?
Well, like you said, it's kind of an irony, but we can never take away the achievements of President Mugabe's government. To this day, Zimbabwe has the highest literacy rate on the African continent due to the policies of Comrade Mugabe. Mm. The health facilities, they are still there. The institutions are there. The facilities are there. What went off the rail a little bit, the maintenance and the ensuring that they are well equipped to continue taking care of Zimbabweans. Probably that's one area that the new government that's there need to work on as a matter of urgency. We cannot continue to have medical tourism, for example, where our leadership goes to seek treatment elsewhere. That doesn't bode well because it brings into question the quality and ability of our own institutions to take care of our own people in Zimbabwe. We do believe that it's of paramount importance to ensure that our health facilities in Zimbabwe are well maintained and our practitioners are well remunerated so that they stay in Zimbabwe and provide the best possible attainable health to all Zimbabweans. That's the goal we look forward to. But like I said, the institutions that were built, the infrastructure that President Mugabe's government put in place is there. All we need to do is to re-equip those our facilities and ensure that our trained manpower is present and well remunerated, well compensated for their service.
What about the saying that if wealth is gone, nothing is gone? If health is gone, something is gone. But if character and integrity are gone, everything is gone.
Well, those are profound statements. But let me bring you back to your earlier question about the deterioration of the services or the surge that we saw in 1980 and the earlier years of President Mugabe in the fields of education, empowerment of local people, health services, development and professionalism of the military service, for instance. Towards the end of the 1990s, that's when we saw the incoming of sanctions and the other economic factors that derailed the development agenda that President Mugabe had set out to do. So it's not entirely that President Mugabe is solely to blame. Mm-hmm. There are other attributing factors. As a matter of fact, there are innumerable factors that contributed to the deterioration of conditions in Zimbabwe that we are still experiencing today.
We'll get to that later. I gather that we are now ready to be joined by Brunette Beatrice Kumaro, a Zimbabwean lecturer and media consultant who joins us from Edmonton, Canada. Good afternoon, Ms. Kumaro.
Good afternoon, Chaka. In the spirit of Ubuntu, my condolences to the Mugabe family, my condolences to the people of Zimbabwe, and my condolences to Africa.
Indeed, our condolences also from Straight Talk Africa to the late former Zimbabwean President Robert Gabriel Mugabe, who, by the way, I had the opportunity to interview in New York in the year 2000, courtesy of George Charamba, the man that made it happen, and through a gentleman by the name Wengweli. I hope that those two will once again make it possible for us to sit down with President Mugabe's successor, President Mnangagwa. Let me come to you again, Ms. Kumalo. What would you say if you were to be objective? What would you say is the single most important decision that was made by Robert Gabriel Mugabe during his presidency? And what about the single most regrettable decision?
The single most important decision, I would say, from the late R.G. Mugabe is about education, where we saw him educating the masses of Zimbabwe who had an unfair, who were in an unfair situation. His policies were good. The literacy levels were high right from independence. He opened more schools. He allowed for adult literacy for those who had lost their educational opportunities during the war. He made it possible to do what was called hot sitting. Some were learning in the morning, some were learning in the afternoon. He had adult literacy colleges. There was education for all. And if you look at the literacy levels right now, Zimbabwe has the highest in Africa. And we are all proud to be Zimbabwean because of the education we have, that we can still operate at international level because of the education, educational policies. So that was the most right thing I appreciate from him. But on the negative side, what I do not appreciate was the corruption which he allowed to destroy our country, to destroy our economy, to impoverish people in a very wealthy country.
What about Gukurahundi in the early 1980s in Matabeleland?
It is regrettable, the genocide and the massacres of over 20,000 people from Matabeleland, of which they blamed the Five Brigade. But he was in charge. He was responsible for all I would have expected him before he died was to take responsibility and say sorry to the people of Matabeleland because people were killed. And that's brutality, being brutal to his own people.
You know, it is very interesting, but I recall one of Zimbabwe's main opposition leaders, the late Morgan Tsvangirai, once told me, he said, Shaka, Zimbabwe and Southern Rhodesia have really been very, very unlucky because they have had three very, very stubborn and bad leaders. He mentioned the man at one time who owned Rhodesia, Sir John Cecil Rhodes. He mentioned the rebel Prime Minister of Southern Rhodesia, Ian Smith, and then he mentioned Robert Gabriel Mugabe, Zimbabwean, of course, independence leader. Isn't it very interesting that when you look at Robert Gabriel Mugabe and you look at Sir John Cecil Rhodes, whose legacy seems to be, in fact, in terms of providing the famous Rhodes Scholarship at Oxford University, that these are two people apparently who really embraced education.
Indeed, however unfortunate it is, I won't talk about Cecil John Rhodes and what he did or brought to Zimbabwe. Yes, now there's a scholarship for education. Well, thank you for that. I hope it will educate more Africans, more Zimbabweans to be able to stand for themselves. But on the issue of Robert Mugabe, he started on a very good note. So really, as the nation of Zimbabwe mourns today, I'll speak for myself, we're sitting on a 50-50. He started well. But something went wrong along the lines. And now it's unfortunate we can't sort of celebrate his life fully because of the brutality, the villain he ended up being. However, he had started well on the contribution. I think it was overstaying and something along the line went wrong, that when nobody could say no to him, it turned to brutality. How unfortunate it became.
Very interesting, Dr. Guni. You know as well as I do that when you look at the Lancaster House independence negotiations,
yes,
it was a very good document, but left in that particular constitution a sort of social political time bomb, the land issue, that you are not to touch the land issue until after 10 years.
Yes.
And during those 10 years, Mugabe was wined and feted by, among others, the Queen of England. He was given a knighthood, for example.
Yes.
He was given many honorary degrees by Western institutions. But when the land was touched later, it became a different ball game. What happened to the fund that had actually been identified to be used for compensating white commercial farmers on the basis of willing farmer, willing seller, willing buyer?
Well, thank
you. It was disbursed initially by someone that used to be called the Iron Lady, Margaret Thatcher.
Yes.
It was also continued to be disbursed by John Major.
Yes.
Only to stop under Tony Blair.
Yes, before we even get to Tony Blair, part of the Lancaster House negotiations protracted because of the land question. Everything else had been agreed pretty fast, but it took over 3 months to conclude the Lancaster House negotiations, basically because of the land clause. But eventually, President Mugabe and his team eventually agreed to sign the agreement, and also in consideration of other African countries, like South Africa, Namibia, that were still to attain their independence. But moving forward, initially, yes, there was a fund, willing buyer, willing seller, and the government administered that program with monitoring and assistance of the British government. But when the Labour government that was headed by Tony Blair came in, they said, we do not recognize those agreements. You had those agreements with a different party in power, and they reneged on those agreements. And when that happened, Zimbabweans had no choice but to say, okay, if you don't want to compensate, if you don't want to honor your own agreements that you signed in 1979, then we are going to take back our land without compensation, since it was also taken without compensation. It was only fair that way. But of course, when that happened, most of the Western powers saw this as a dangerous precedent that would trigger a land repossession by all African countries, which would dispossess commercial white farmers and corporate bodies that have owned land for hundreds of years in Africa.
Especially they feared across the Limpopo.
Yes, especially in
South Africa.
South Africa and Namibia next door. Especially South Africa, where majority of the Zimbabwe former Rhodesian whites actually moved to South Africa at independence. Some of them never came back to Zimbabwe.
Okay.
And those that were there were now saying, well, if Mugabe takes land, this is going to move down to South Africa. It's going to move to Namibia. It's going to move to other African countries, and we are going to have a serious problem. That's when you saw the ostracization of President Mugabe, the seclusion of Zimbabwe, and the imposition of sanctions.
Well, I hope you don't mind, Dr. Guni. We have to go to Ms. Kumalo in Edmonton, Canada. Your reaction, Ms. Kumalo?
I beg to differ a bit on the issue of land. They were paid the money. That's where the corruption started. I believe totally the land needed to go to the people. But the money they were given over £800 million to do that. But because they used the money for other things, then they want to blame it on Tony Blair. On that issue, I beg to differ. The money was given. What did they do with the money? Who did they give the, who did they do the willing buyer, willing seller with the money they got from the British, in as much as I appreciate land redistribution, and that is in the land of the people, in the hands of the people now.
Well, unfortunately, Ms. Kumalo, time is not our best ally. You are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of a discussion in a moment, so please don't go away, because we'll be right back with you.
We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about, sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower, and change the rules. It's time for Our Voices with me, Heidi Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
It's time for Our Voices.
Today's youth are not just the next generation of African leaders, they are today's leaders. And this is the time to invest in them. Today, not tomorrow. So let's connect, let's engage with each other on issues that will transform our societies.
Innovation, leadership, entrepreneurship, things that you're doing to move the continent forward to make you the greatest generation that Africa has known.
It's Upfront every Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Earlier, we talked about the legacy of Robert Mugabe and how, and now I have the pleasure to welcome Ambassador Tijani Muhammad Bande, the new president-elect of the United Nations General Assembly. Well, Ambassador Bande, I have to say that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you on Straight Talk Africa for the first time.
Yeah, I thank you very much for the invitation. I am also honored to have a conversation with you and your numerous listeners.
I am exceedingly humbled, and I certainly look forward to interacting with you for the next 30 minutes. First of all, what is it like to be referred to as the President of the United Nations General Assembly? Because, in fact, there are some people probably downtown Lagos who are basically rumoring around that you just became the president of the world.
Well, what it is that the president of the General Assembly presides for a particular session. In this particular case, in my particular case, for the 74th session of the United Nations General Assembly, which lasts a year, September of a given year to September of another year. So it is presiding over the affairs of the General Assembly. The General Assembly is an important organ within the United Nations system. It is the deliberative body where representatives of all countries, all member states of the United Nations sit and negotiate and discuss all issues that are important to the world. But it is better known around the world in the functions it has of receiving every year during the general debate, which is the beginning of each session, heads of state and government coming to the United Nations to discuss issues of urgent concern to the world. Those issues at times are structured around a particular theme. And this has been going on from the beginning of the establishment of the United Nations. It's a very, very important position, and every person so entrusted to leadership of that really important World Assembly is well honored with a huge responsibility, which must be taken very seriously indeed. No, he's not the president of the world. He is President of the General Assembly, which is a body of 193 member states. Nigeria is one of the 193, and it is an honor to preside over the Assembly at its 74th session.
And when you talk about the United Nations General Assembly, Are we looking at something akin, perhaps, to a world sort of parliament?
Yes, it has, obviously, some relationship to a parliament in that it does make laws, even if the laws are not really binding as such, but it sets targets, it sets norms for the world in relation to many things concerning development, concerning the oceans, concerning literally everything. So it is a parliament in that several issues are brought and resolutions are debated and taken if agreeable to the membership. If there is a parliament of the world, certainly it would be the United Nations General Assembly.
What about some who say that when you talk about the UN General Assembly, you are probably looking at an institution within the United Nations that happens to be, in their words, not mine, democratic. They say that because it goes about electing people and countries participate in those elections, unlike, for example, the more powerful body, which is the UN Security Council.
No, that perception is certainly a wrong one. The United Nations General Assembly is one of six organs of importance to the world as part of the United Nations as a system. Each part is extremely important in the work of the organization. Now, elections are conducted and really important discussions and decisions are made by the General Assembly. Of course, the better known organ that deals with what is called world peace is the one dealing with the Security Council, which you referred to. The Security Council decisions are also mandatory in terms of being binding, but not everything that is of importance or of importance to the world is in the purview of the Security Council. It is limited in what it does. It cannot deal with everything, and it will obviously not be right to refer certain things that have little direct connection to security matters world to the Security Council. Yes, the 15 members, including 5 permanent members, have real power for the period they are there, whether they are permanent. But even those who are not permanent, they have an opportunity to contribute. It is a contribution to maintenance of peace. This is critical. But all other organs are important, and all other organs do extremely important work. No certain matters concerning boundaries, concerning boundaries of countries, of oceans, agreements of real value in relation to development, including the Sustainable Development Goals agreed to in 2015, I think are all things done under the auspices of the General Assembly. It is extremely important.
What about critics who say that the UN General Assembly, yes, has teeth, but that those teeth do not bite? That the teeth that bite are found in the UN Security Council, which, of course, as you said, happens to have 5 permanent members, of which Africa is not a member.
Well, I think the issue is this. The first element is really the whole question of what are the rules, what are the norms. These norms are set by and large by the generality of all of us, and it is at the General Assembly where every member of the world community as a nation has equal vote. Now, the 15 as 15 do not stand alone, because they are not 15, because they are only 15 out of within a certain called the United Nations. They are a subset of the system, and powerful as the five are, as you say, they do not constitute the totality of the work either of the Security Council or of the United Nations as a whole. Yes, it is true, it is a great position of power, if not of an authority, to be in that body. And yes, it is true, Africa is not represented on that council on a permanent basis, but Africa is represented by three members on a non-permanent basis. They have extremely important role to play in that particular position. Yes, there have been over at least a quarter of a century very focused discussion concerning how not only Africa but other regions or other parts of the world can also belong to the Council in a manner that is considered reflective of not only the New World, but also the geographical spread of the world itself. I think that is important too. But no, it's not the case that the only thing that matters in the United Nations is the Security Council. That will not certainly be an exaggeration.
What about the fact that, yes, you do have, for example, those three countries from Africa that you have mentioned, which sit at the Security Council, but of course they do not have or enjoy veto power, like the five permanent representatives, and we're talking about the United States, the United Kingdom, France, Russia, and China. What about the fact also that a veto, unlike in other organizations like, say, the United States Senate, a veto at the United Nations Security Council cannot be overridden?
That is the setting of the mandate in terms of the charter. And the whole question of whether that should continue, and if it should continue, how it will look or should look like, is part of the discussion concerning elements to be discussed in relation to the reform of the Security Council. And why? This is because, as you have observed, many have said that we need to consider what it is that the Security Council should do, including representation, including whether there will be a veto, and if there is a veto, how it might be exercised. These are matters under discussion. Yes, those countries that represent Africa in the case you are dealing with have important roles to play within the Council, and other members who are not permanent members also play a very important role in discussing important matters of war and peace. And this is where we are at. The organization's charter was drafted and agreed to in 1945. That's a long period ago, a long time ago. And we are beginning from next year, we are celebrating or commemorating the 75th anniversary. And with it, of course, there have been focused discussion concerning what should be done 75 years on to the charter to reflect changing realities. This is where we are at. It's a difficult process, but it is a process already started, and it is important. There is no question. Representation is important. The whole question of power within the Council is important, but these are matters under discussion.
You know, the first president of the UN General Assembly from the African continent was a great Ghanaian by the name Alex Kwasun Sake. He became president of the United Nations General Assembly, if I remember correctly, in 1964. In 1964, you had what people sometimes refer to as the Congo crisis. And as you get ready to take your position, you still have a crisis that has never really been resolved in the Great Lakes region, especially the Congo. Do you have any plans to figure out how that can be resolved?
Well, I think you make a very important point, and that's an issue concerning longevity of conflicts that have harmed Africa and also other parts of the world. The Congo crisis and from DRC down have been a really serious one, and it is still continuing. But the situation has changed in that, first of all, the African Union itself is stronger in what it does in relation to peace. Countries also are now better able to deal with conscious of peace. And the United Nations is giving its support to conflict resolution and especially conflict prevention. Peacekeeping, there are norms concerning peacekeeping. And there are also formal memoranda of understanding between, say, the United Nations as an organization and some regional bodies, especially the AU, in relation to how matters to do with reduction of conflict and bringing development in place of conflict, I think, can be undertaken. But more and more, those conflicts in the region have been bad. They have not been, they are not things that anybody is happy about. But first of all, the AU as an AU and also sub-regional organizations have played useful roles, even if occasionally there have been missteps by some one or two members of a particular of some of the sub-regions. But in the main, it is a problem, but its intensity has reduced, and the coordination of efforts, both sub-regionally and regionally, has been far better.
You know, the last time there was a Nigerian president of the UN Security, UN General Assembly, I believe it was a Brigadier General Joseph Garba. Is that correct?
Major General Joseph Garba, yes.
That was 1989. And he was able at least to lead the charge towards ending apartheid in South Africa and having a lot of those countries south of Limpopo become liberated. What is it that you came up with if you were to talk to us from the deepest, better part of the bottom of your Nigerian heart and soul? What is it that you must accomplish during your tenure at the UN General Assembly in New York?
Well, thank you very much. Certainly, we as Africans, not just as Nigerians, take pride in the collective work we did to work with like-minded persons at the United Nations to help end apartheid. Nigeria played an important role, and General Garba was part of that process. Other Nigerian envoys at the UN before him also were part of that process, where in Nigeria, being considered as a frontline state, as if it were a South African country, took the lead as part of the African effort. Now, we are happy with that work. So is the continent. My own approach is that today, the global community, represented by the United Nations as a body, has agreed the Sustainable Development Goals, negotiated, agreed to 2015. And I'll be extremely happy to play a role to push implementation of that agenda, because for Africa and for the world, those goals are important. And for Africa, because my own theme for the 74th session really reflects fundamentally those goals, and they resonate very well with Africa. They deal with poverty eradication, they deal with zero hunger, they deal with quality education, they deal with inclusion, they deal with climate action. These are really important issues for Africa, but also for the world. So mine is really now for today. We're not dealing with apartheid. We are lucky we have gone beyond it, but we are dealing with things that ravage humanity in terms of climate inaction, things that have to do with exclusion, things that have to do with poverty. So these are the ones now that are at the forefront of the effort globally. And I certainly have undertaken that the office will focus on those elements for the 74th session.
For the sake of the audience, I should point out that that agenda, the Sustainable Development Goals, were actually put in place by the last African president of the UN General Assembly, Ugandan Foreign Minister Sam Kutesa. So how far have we gone along that line? Do you have a report card on that, Mr. Ambassador?
Well, I think for us, one, we are having challenges by and large relating to what we are hearing. Financing has been an issue. Financing is important. But we also are having a remarkable sense that of urgency, and that's why there will be a review during the 74th session around further commitments and commitments to action to guarantee that, one, we are able to achieve the goals by 2030, which is the timeline we have given to achieve what we have agreed to achieve in 2015, that we are also able to forge the necessary partnerships that are key to having all countries to achieve all the goals to the extent that it would make really a difference in the life of ordinary people. And that is really the task now, to push toward implementation, to find means of financing, to also share information and ideas about how countries that are struggling are able to really be assisted to succeed in getting the goals really reached. There are 17 of them, and they are really critical to all nations.
President Bandi, let's humanize you a bit. As I did my homework, I learned, of course, that you come with impeccable credentials. You've been a leader in so many aspects of life, and you have done very, very, very well. Talk to us about what it is really like being president of the UN General Assembly and sitting on top of that Manhattan Secretariat. Walk us through, for example, a day in the life of Ambassador Dr. Bandi, the President of the United Nations General Assembly. Walk us through a day in your life.
Well, I think for me it is really just an honor to have an opportunity to serve. Service is really the issue. I have been fortunate in my life, and education is key, and the support of others has been really necessary, and everyone has something to contribute to the well-being of their community, their society, and the world. And the frustrations that can happen in the life of Tijani Bande can happen in the life of everyone. But the issue is really to put the goal very clear that we must achieve, because it is important for ourselves and for the world to reduce inequality, to bring dignity to all human beings, and to sustain the environment in such a way that our grandchildren and those after them will have a world at peace, a world that is sustainably exploited for the benefit of future generations. This is really key. It is an important responsibility, and I am humbled by the support. I have gotten a lot of support, and it's not a collect, it's not an individual work, but I am glad to be in this role at this moment.
Mr. President, who are your role models, or who is your role model? Who is the individual or individuals who lent you their shoulders to climb on so that you could see a little bit further than them?
Believe you me, there are many. It is difficult to mention one. I have had a lot of influences in my life. I learned from a lot of people from really, really different traditions. I could mention many. Believe you me, there are many that I am humbled by what they have done, and I wish I am able to do a little like they have done. But it's not just one. There are many from different nations, even different cultures, different religions, that I find having done extremely well. Gandhi, you can talk of Mandela, you can talk of Sadona in Nigeria, you can talk of Balewa, you can talk of Nkrumah, you can talk of Martin Luther King, you can talk of even younger ones, the work younger people are doing concerning the environment. These are also models for us today. The young girl who insists that we must have education at all costs, the young girl who insists that we should look after the environment, those who defend religious sites of different religions, not their own. These are really there every day. They are there.
Unfortunately, time happens not to be our best ally. Next time, of course, I will ask you to talk to the small girl, the small boy in Abeokuta, Nigeria, what he or she needs to do in order to be able to walk effectively in your footsteps.
I'll be honored to engage in that discussion. It is a very important one. The youth are key.
Thank
really.
You. Thank you. Well, on that note, our distinguished guests are Frank Guni, Brunette Beatrice Kumaro, Blessing Zuru, and Tijan Muhammad Bande. Thanks to our audience for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Africa. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.
Welcome to